This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When we think of undercover agents, it's usually the CIA, the FBI, or the DEA that comes to mind, not the Fish and Wildlife Service. But wildlife agents are going undercover to protect endangered species from poachers and to infiltrate the international black market in the meat, skins, and bones of endangered species. My guest is environmental journalist Mark Reisner. His new book, Game Wars, is about the undercover pursuit of wildlife poachers. Reisner spent several years following around Dave Hall, a fish and wildlife agent who has gone undercover as an alligator poacher, an oil leasing businessman with a sideline in illegal furs, ivory, and cocaine, and a Mississippi caterer who specializes in illegal wild game. According to Reisner, this international black market is so lucrative, it poses a significant threat to several endangered species.
The rhinoceros, for example, which was very common in Africa 50 to 75 years ago, is now down to the last few thousand specimens. The rhinoceros may not make it outside of zoos. There are too few left. The reason is because rhinoceros horn in Korea ground up as a powder, and it's considered a sort of a thaumaturgical cure-all. It's anything from an aphrodisiac to something that will prolong your life. It's selling for $5,000 per pound, which is about what cocaine sells for. Rhinoceros horn 20 or 30 years ago didn't fetch $100 a pound. Now it's $5,000 a pound. We have a lot of rich societies, especially Asian societies, that value wildlife parts, ivory, rhinoceros horn, polar bear skins, which can sell for as much as $50,000 in Japan. And there's tremendous pressure on a lot of these species, especially species that have never been that common, like polar bears. So you have a big, thriving international black market in wildlife. It's never going to go away. And, you know, the groups like the Sierra Club, as effective as they are when it comes to things like air pollution and national park preservation, aren't really on the vanguard of the effort to save those species. It's this tiny little cadre of undercover game wardens, uniformed game wardens, and groups like Wildlife Conservation International. They are the samurai class of the conservation movement. They are out there actually doing battle, and in many cases gun battle, with these ruthless poacher types who are going after endangered species all over the world.
Did you go to any of the black market connections?
Well, I went undercover a couple of times with Dave Hall, my protagonist, and scared the hell out of me. I mean, you can't imagine the kind of people we were out with. They stepped right off the screen in Deliverance. I don't know whether you've seen that movie. You remember those two mountain men?
Mm-hmm.
Well, those are the kinds of people we were out with. These were ruthless killers. And, the father of one of these guys had been a contract killer. That's how he made his living. He assassinated people. And they were killing wildlife, all kinds of wildlife. They were killing turtles. This is down in Louisiana. Alligators. They were netting ducks and selling them. They're big black markets throughout the South because it's a Southern tradition, especially in Cajun Louisiana, that you eat wild food. A lot of these people haven't gone to a supermarket to buy a piece of meat in years. Almost everything they eat, they kill, and almost all of it illegally.
Are these poaching rings largely made up of individuals, or is there a lot of international organized crime behind it?
Well, one of the big ivory dealers whom Dave Hall almost caught, he didn't get him essentially because the government attorneys blew the case, was a major figure in the East Coast Mafia. He was involved in all kinds of stuff, but one of his big businesses was elephant ivory. He also bought walrus ivory, but he had probably 40 people doing nothing but rendering elephant ivory into jewelry and carvings and things like that, all of it illegal. He was making millions of dollars. He had a 12-bedroom house, three-story house that was built largely on the profits of illegal wildlife. And this guy had two armed guards patrolling his grounds, and he had anti-bugging equipment in the house, which he said was as sophisticated as what they had in the White House. And as Dave Hall walked into his house to sell him some illegal ivory, Walrus Ivory, the guy said, by the way, if you're bugged, my bugging anti-bugging equipment is going to detect it, and you'll be killed. He walked into the house. He had on a $5,000, very sophisticated Nagra Swedish-made tape recorder, which did not set the anti-bugging equipment off. But I said, how could you do that? How could you walk into that house when they said they'd shoot you? He said, well, first of all, I was going to have my gun out first. Secondly, what am I going to do? Say, you got me. I'm your man. I didn't have any choice. So these guys have, and the women as well, have nerves of very tensile steel. And I think they are to be admired.
You've talked about how great the risks are for undercover work. Have undercover fish and wildlife agents been killed?
In 1984, four were killed. These were game wardens, not all undercover. The risk, according to Dave Hall, the risk of being a game warden is 200% greater than the risk of being a city cop.
What does a game warden do exactly?
The risk of death or injury. Well, a game warden is going to go out and do everything from check fishing licenses to get in mad dog chases with deer spotlighters, guys who, you know, shoot deer by the dozen from their cars with a big, powerful spotlight. It's a very common violation. Everybody they meet is armed, at least in hunting season, usually with a high-powered rifle. A lot of these guys are rednecks. They're basically violent people, and they hate the idea that anybody tells them they can't go out and shoot whatever they want. Some of them are doing it commercially for pretty good money, big money. You can't imagine how, and you have no backup, especially if you're undercover. An undercover drug cop has a van load of agents waiting to jump on the perpetrators. He's got surveillance up in the fourth floor window. He's got all kinds of sophisticated electronic beepers and things like that on him. If he gets in trouble, somebody's going to try to get him out of it quick. Now, Dave Hall has been undercover with illegal groups of people in the middle of nowhere, in the bayou in Louisiana, up in Alaska, big game hunters, politically very influential people who, if they were caught, could lose their careers. Now, you know, a guide or somebody like that in the middle of nowhere discovers that one of the members of the party is an undercover game warden. What are they going to do to avoid being caught? Think about it.
The story of the alligator is an interesting case study in endangered species. And you described the alligator as one of the greatest success stories, the recovery of the alligator is one of the greatest success stories in North American wildlife conservation. When was the alligator first threatened?
I think you have to call it the greatest success story. The alligator was threatened, I would say, when Art Deco, the Art Deco age, made alligator skin fashionable. It's essentially used for urban wear, for purses, for fancy shoes, for handbags, things like that. And as we became an increasingly urban society in the 20s and 30s, and alligators became very fashionable, you can go to an Art Deco show and find clocks made out of alligator skins. The species was overhunted at a spectacular rate. Florida had something like 2,200,000 alligators probably around World War I. By 1968, there were about 40,000 left, almost all of them in the Everglades. And the poachers were going in there with impunity at night and hunting alligators. One state after another lost its alligators, lost 97, 98, 99% of them. So it became an endangered species, a federally listed endangered species. It was one of the first ones put on the list back in the late 60s. But still, there were 2,000 people who were used to making their living from killing alligators. And some of these guys were making, $100,000 a year back then, which was 10 or 20 times more money than they could make doing anything else. So they just wouldn't stop. And the game wardens could go out and try to chase them down in airboats and things like that. But these were very wily, well-organized poaching gangs. And it was mainly Dave Hall organizing a bunch of front operations that bought illegal alligators and then busted the people who sold them that shut down this whole network that ranged all the way to Japan of alligator smugglers and tanners and dealers. And finally, when the hunters had no one to sell to anymore, the alligator recovered amazingly. Louisiana has probably 600,000 to 700,000 now, as opposed to maybe 50,000 20 years ago.
I know, I was just in New Orleans for a conference, and it had rained really hard before I got there, and I was told that it was really hard to get anywhere because there were alligators all over the road. How did the alligators make such an incredible comeback after being an endangered species?
Well, it's an adaptable animal. It's a lot like deer. You know, deer were very scarce in New England 200 years ago because everybody hunted them for food. Now we probably have more deer in this country than we had 200 years ago. Same thing with the alligator. They once they're, you know, left reasonably alone, there is a legal alligator season now. They take about 40 or 50,000 a year. But that's I hate to use the word harvest, but that's what the game management people use. That is a manageable kill. You're not going to endanger the species by taking that many. And alligators have learned to coexist with human beings quite well, at least in the core of their habitat. They used to range all the way up to southern Illinois. I don't think we're ever going to see alligators that far north again. But the populations in Florida, in Alabama, and Louisiana, where they're quite thick, seem to be stable.
Let me ask you, when you go to New Orleans, there's a lot of alligator dishes on the menu. Do you eat alligator? Would you eat it? Do you think that...
I had it once.
Uh-huh.
I don't think it's very good.
Well, beyond the taste, what do you think, you know, ethically about eating alligators? Any problem with that?
Well, I think that in order to save wild species, it's a sad fact that they have to have some commercial value. Maybe not species like the bald eagle, which has an intrinsic value as our national bird, but species like deer, species like ducks. If weren't for the deer hunters and the duck hunters, we wouldn't have any habitat left because those are the people who really give a damn about saving habitat. And the same applies to the alligator. So I think it's a sad but true fact that people who are interested in wildlife conservation have to accept the premise that wildlife has to be hunted to some degree, within manageable constraints, and that it's the hunters who really, you know, the wildlife user types, I'm talking about groups like Ducks Unlimited, who have really gone the extra mile to save habitat. Groups like Friends of Animals are essentially opposed to hunting, and I can understand that ethically. But Friends of Animals has not bought 2 million acres of waterfowl habitat in Canada as Ducks Unlimited has done.
So you're not against hunting?
No, I'm not.
And you think that the hunters, in a way, are really helping to save... Some hunters are helping to save some species because they have a vested interest in making sure that the species propagate.
Unfortunately so. Of course, you have good ethical hunters like Aldo Leopold, who was a big hunter. And then you have trash hunters. You have the you know, commercial hunters who are really the equivalent of the Medellin cartel. Wildlife to them is just an opportunity to make a lot of money. And if the species goes extinct, that's too bad. Those are the people that undercover wildlife agents like Dave Hall are obsessed with catching.
Are there any lessons that we can learn from the revival of the alligator that can be applied to other endangered species?
Sure. First of all, we have to save habitat. We're losing habitat all the time. We've got a policy that now allegedly of no net loss of wetlands. We're still losing 400 to 500,000 acres of wetlands per year. We're just nibbling away at the edges of the miserable little vestiges of wildlife habitat, of good wildlife habitat that we have left. If we're serious about having wild creatures around us and... I don't know how you can measure their value. I mean, I can't imagine a world without wildlife. I'd like to see a lot more than we have, and that's possible. But we have to, first of all, not just save habitat, but recreate it. We've lost so much habitat that we have to get serious now about recreating habitat. And we're doing that to some degree in some places. We're doing that, for example, in Chesapeake Bay, where there's an enormous citizen effort to restore the health of that estuary. But we're losing it at a fantastic rate in Florida. We're losing it in southern Louisiana. We're losing it in California, most of the western states.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Reisner, and he's an investigative environmental reporter. His new book is called Game Wars, The Undercover Pursuit of Wildlife Poachers. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Mark Reisner is my guest, author of the new book, Game Wars, The Undercover Pursuit of Wildlife Poachers. You looked at poaching in the south of Louisiana and in Alaska, among other places. And in Louisiana and in Alaska, there were native populations who were in part responsible for the poaching. You raise the issue in your book of the need to teach native cultures a conservation ethic. What are some of the problems involved in doing that? I mean, I think that in some of these cases, the native cultures aren't used to a conservation ethic because there's a tradition of living off the land. And what is more basic than that? I mean, how do you tell somebody, well, you can't live off the land anymore?
Well, let's put it this way. The Eskimos in Alaska didn't have a cash economy. They didn't know what money was until about 40 years ago. They hunted for subsistence, meaning they hunted for food, they hunted for clothing. They hunted a walrus to make skin boats, which they went out in. They didn't have high-powered motors. They didn't have snowmobiles. So they didn't have, high-powered rifles. It was very difficult for them to take a lot of animals. It was a treacherous, dangerous, difficult business. Now they have essentially army-scale weaponry, and they have things like satellite television, things like cocaine and marijuana that they want to spend money on. So they are out there waging war against the species that they've always depended on, so they can spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on all these accoutrements of civilization that they've now been taught that they want and need. So subsistence is a joke. There's a subsistence exemption in the Endangered Species Act that allows Eskimos essentially to hunt as many animals as they want. But what they're doing is selling them clandestinely to big white smugglers, and buying all of these things that they never thought they needed in the past. That subsistence business really has to be rethought and revised, or not just the animals, but the culture itself is going to go out.
So you think that consumer culture has corrupted native cultures, and in turn native cultures hunt in a different way and hunt for different reasons than they once did?
Absolutely. It's a terrible tragedy.
You know, a lot of people think that a lot of environmentalists are really very naive in the way they approach things, and I wonder if, after writing Game Wars, you think there are parts of the environmental movement that indeed are naive.
Well, I've always felt that. I think, people who think the only way to save wildlife is to ban hunting are completely off base. The way to save wildlife is to keep hunting legal, regulated severely, and as Hall does again and again, turn these poacher types into born-again conservationists. He doesn't just arrest these guys, he converts them. And they've become some of his strongest evangelical conservation types. There's a guy named Dennis Treitler who made his living as an outlaw for the last 25, 30 years. Dave Hall finally put him in jail. And when he got out, went and preached conservation at him so effectively that Treitler now is running all over the South to hunter groups, Boone and Crockett clubs, and giving that same message out. He spoke to the National Convention of Ducks Unlimited. George Bush was there. You have a lot of rich hunter types, not just these sort of hillbilly types who are taking serious over limits of ducks because they think, oh, we're rich, real rich guys, so we can do whatever we want. Treitler just poured a whole bucket load of venom on them as well.
Are you still in touch with Dave Hall, the undercover agent who you write about in your book?
Oh, very much so. We're going to be collaborating on a movie, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, based on his life.
A theatrical film?
Yes. First run, I hope. We're working with a couple of Hollywood producers right now, trying to iron out the deal.
And who does he see as playing Dave Hall?
Well, he would like to see Robert Redford, who has expressed an interest. Redford, I'm not sure is the right kind of guy.
Real tough as leather kind of guy, huh?
Yeah. Clint Eastwood would make a better Dave Hall than Robert Redford. I've always said that Dave Hall is a combination of Clint Eastwood and David Brower. But I don't know who's going to end up doing it.
Our producer suggests Ed Harris.
Ed Harris would be pretty good.
Tommy Lee Jones, maybe?
Tommy Lee Jones would be excellent. He even looks like Dave Hall. Thank you. Thank your producer very much for that tip.
I'll take credit for the Tommy Lee Jones suggestion.
Tommy Lee Jones, that's good. I like that. I like that. Because Dave Hall is part Indian, and he has a little of that, part Indian look. He has some acne scars on his face. He's a very rough-looking guy. You never believe this guy is a law enforcement officer. He looks like a real hoodlum.
So you don't think you have a future in undercover work, huh?
Well, it's intoxicating. I found it, you know, they undercover people say if you can get used to the danger, it's as addictive as drugs, and I can see that. It was very addictive, that living on that margin, on that threshold. And, you know, these guys have, their family life is often in ruins. And there are women who do it as well, and their family life is in ruins. The divorce rate is astronomical, something like 75%. They're gone so much, they're living on the edge, and they become obsessed. But you have to be not just obsessed with what you're doing, you have to be obsessed with your goal, whether you're trying to get rid of the scourge of narcotics or the scourge of poaching. You have to be absolutely committed, because if you think to yourself, why the hell am I doing this anyway? Why am I taking serious risks for an alligator? Then you're done. You're doomed. And many of them quit when they start thinking that way.
Mark Reisner, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Mark Reisner is an environmental investigative journalist. He's the author of the new book, Game Wars: The Undercover Pursuit of Wildlife Poachers. This is Fresh Air.